Monday, June 23rd. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
So, Kevin, you know, big things happened over the weekend. The U.S. launched Operation Midnight Hammer, deploying 125-plus warplanes and 7 B-2 bombers to drop massive bunker busters on 3 Iranian nuclear facilities. Pretty big deal.
Yeah.
President Trump declared that Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely obliterated, and now there are threats of retaliation. So today, we're going to look forward. What now? Is the U.S. strike a one-and-done effort, or will we get dragged into a protracted war in the Middle East? And this is your opportunity to weigh in, because we all have feelings, Kevin, about this. People are thinking about this. People are worried. Some people are applauding this effort. And so we want to get your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. You can call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave those reactions, all your thoughts, in the live chat.
This is one of those stories where it's unfolding on a Saturday night, and I feel like a lot of us are processing it over the weekend, trying to figure out, are we in a new world era? What's going on? What do we make of this? What is this going to mean for us personally? What's this going to mean for geopolitics? And that's why we have this show, so we can unpack these big issues, talk to some great experts, and hopefully get some great feedback from our callers today. So, again, your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. Give us a call, 888-477-9499 or studio2@whyy.org. Okay, but first, a trio of news local news stories.
Yes.
Well, Cherry, the Philadelphia region is in the middle of a brutal heat wave, you may have noticed.
Yes, very hot this morning.
The city declared a health heat emergency yesterday, activating cooling centers, pausing Philadelphia Water Department shutoffs. There's a code red in effect for the city's Office of Homeless Services. The Philadelphia Inquirer has this pretty handy resource out over time. Wanted to give them a shout out. It lets you compare how hot our region has been over time. So you kind of can go in there at any time from 1950 through present day, essentially, you can see, well, how hot really was it? I feel like we have this debate in my house all the time. My wife says, it's so hot. I was like, it's always hot in the summertime, right? But if you dig into the data, she actually gets proven right here.
Okay? Yeah.
So I was born in the 80s, and according to the Inquirer, Philadelphia saw an average of 20 days above 90 degrees per year, and we now see an average of 30 days.
Yes.
So 10 more days above 90 degrees per year. And they also have a tool that helps you take the humidity into account, you know, the heat index, the real feel, they call it. 36 days in the early 80s where the heat index was above 90 degrees. And now we see on average 49 days where the heat index is above 90 degrees. So if you've felt like it's been hotter in recent years, the data is on your side.
And I have to say that this year specifically, I sort of forgot that we were in summer, because just a couple weeks ago, we were still in the 60s at night. And now all of a sudden, we're at 101 feel today. Yep. And so it just feels like my body wasn't even ready for this ramp up of heat that seemed to me happened so quickly.
And then the question is, well, what do you do about it?
Right? Yeah.
So personally, like, I came back from a vacation week and it was like, got to go down the basement, go into the crawl space, get the AC units out, get them in, soaking with sweat, just like getting these units in. And everybody kind of has their own rituals for how they kind of really begin summer when it gets so sweltering out.
Yeah, this is like multi-shower a day weather. Which means I use a lot of lotion, right? And then also, you know, I have a garden on my rooftop, a lot of water. So I'm just, you know, I try to think about how to conserve water at the same time. So yeah, and summer is here.
Speaking of what to do about it, tomorrow on the show, we're going to explore some solutions for how cities can adapt infrastructure to mitigate the effects of extreme heat.
Yeah, the heat, we're going to be riding the heat right now. That's what we're going to be talking about. Our second story, a pretty serious one. Jury selection begins today in the case involving the murder of Temple University police officer Christopher Fitzgerald. 20-year-old Miles Pfeffer of Bucks County faces the possibility of life without parole if he is convicted of the 2023 murder of Fitzgerald. And if you remember the incident from a couple of years ago, the incident really shocked the city. Fitzgerald had been patrolling campus. He spotted this pfeffer who was at the time a senior in high school. And, you know, he tried to stop him. A scuffle occurred and, you know, it ended with Fitzgerald shot. And during pretrial proceedings, prosecutors said that they plan to play a video of the shooting that shows Pfeffer, who I mentioned was in high school, sort of standing over 31-year-old Fitzgerald and firing a gun several times at his head and face. And this sort of riled the community up. Fitzgerald comes from a law enforcement family. His father is former officer in the Philadelphia Police Department. His wife has been very vocal. They had actually called for the death penalty in this case. They were on this show around that summer after the killing happened. And, District Attorney Larry Krasner declined to pursue the death penalty. So that'll bring that issue up again.
It was such a brutal story and remains so, right? You have this father of four who is gunned down in the middle of, you know, Temple University campus. It raised all these questions about whether or not he should have been alone that night, if he should have been in patrol with someone else. And you're just like, what in the world is this, you know, teenager from the suburbs doing in Philly?
Yeah.
Ends up, you know, allegedly killing this officer. So we'll be watching very closely to what happens in this story.
And by the way, Pfeffer is charged with murder of a law enforcement officer, which has enhancements, as well as firearm violations. And he's represented by the Defender Association of Philadelphia. Several days is likely to, you know, have this trial proceeding take place. So we'll be watching as jury selection continues.
All right, Cherry, switching gears here. Mm-hmm. Imagine you walk into your first day of class, college class this fall. You sit down at your desk and the professor hits you with this.
Walk in New Orleans with the etiquette of LA yelling.
Oh, man. So that is Kendrick Lamar's hit song TV Off from his 2024 album GNX. And starting this fall at Temple University, students will be able to take an entire course dedicated to Kendrick's work. The course is titled Kendrick Lamar and the Morale of Mad City, taught by Timothy Welbeck. He's a professor of Africology and African American Studies. Now, you might recall headlines, Cherry, about Taylor Swift.
Yeah, kind of being, I remember
that. A bunch
that.
Of big college courses, and she's had courses on her work at Harvard, Stanford, University of Texas, and others. And now I think there's some people who kind of scoff at courses like these. But
who are those people?
I'm going to argue that, you know, Kendrick is definitely deserving of a deep study of his work. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for one.
Okay.
And if you know his work, you know he's building like stories and rich lyrical content with all these double and triple.
You look very passionate. Yeah.
I'm telling you. I got to say, one of my favorite podcasts to shout it out is this a Spotify podcast called Dissect. And it literally is this guy going through every Kendrick song and like going through it like it's a literary study.
It's layered. It's multi-layered. Layered. Okay, I'm convinced.
If you can study a course on Yates, I'd say you can study a course on Kendrick. That's my argument.
I believe you. Yes. And I'm convinced about Kendrick Lamar.
So here's my question, though, right? There is going to be a line, Cherry, right? Where do you draw the line when it comes to some of these like pop culture courses? Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe I could play the role of, a professor trying to pitch a new course
I'm
to
the dean,
university,
right?
And you're the dean.
Okay. Dean hat, okay. Let's do it.
So here's three hypothetical courses that I would pitch as a university professor. You're the dean. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's number one.
Okay.
Cisco as Sisyphus, How the Thong Song Defines American Late Stage Capitalist Ennui.
Bam. No.
No?
No, I don't think. I mean, I like Cisco and I like this thong song, but I don't think it rises to a level where we're going to add capitalism in there. Go ahead.
You didn't buy what I was selling.
I did not buy it at all. Not one penny worth. Okay. No.
Course number two. Now, remember, I'm an assistant professor. I'm trying to get tenure here.
You're trying to get tenure. Well, you're not going to get it with Cisco, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Number two. Oh, Beyonce, can you see Queen Bey and the redefining of the patriotism industrial complex?
Patriotism. Wow. I always would approve most, you know, classes involving Beyonce. And I feel like you can, you know, depending on what album you choose, you can make it work. But patriotism, I don't know. I'm going to give it a mid. I'll tell you to go work on that syllabus. Last one.
Fair enough. All right, last one. Paradise by the Dashboard Light, what Meatloaf's extended baseball sex metaphor teaches us about free trade and the fall of the American auto industry.
I don't know. Kevin, you didn't convince me as Dean to do any of these classes.
You're not buying it.
I'm so sorry. All right.
If any assistant professors out there who want to take these ideas and run with them, maybe you'll find a dean. Please do.
And they would probably be a lot easier than me. And you never know what the students want to hear or when a... You know, I definitely want to play some Kendrick Lamar in class. And, you know, if you get to listen to the music you love in class, it doesn't really feel like class at all.
All right. But switching gears back to the serious topic we have at hand, Sherry.
We'll be talking about the war in Iran. Is the U.S. strike that took place over the weekend, are we going to be dragged into this war? We want your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. Email studio2@whyy.org, and we'll see you on the other side of this break. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. Late Saturday night, President Donald Trump addressed the nation from the White House after the U.S. military carried out airstrikes on three nuclear sites in Iran. Standing behind him were Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
Iran, the bully of the Middle East, must now make peace. If they do not, future attacks will be far greater and a lot easier. I want to thank and congratulate Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. We worked as a team like perhaps no team has ever worked before.
Sunday morning, Defense Secretary Hegseth said Trump's order was, quote, focused, powerful, and clear. And many within President Trump's inner circle are standing behind him. But there is some division within the broader Republican Party. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about the airstrikes on Iran and U.S. intervention in the Middle East. We have two guests joining us now via Zoom. We have Sean Yam, an associate professor of political science at Temple University. Sean, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And we also have Peter Berkowitz, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Peter, thank you so much for being here.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
And I want our listeners to join the conversation. What's your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you are watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the chat. And so, Sean and Peter, I want to start our conversation with what we saw this weekend. The U.S. military launched one of the most significant airstrikes in years using stealth bombers and bunker busters on Iranian nuclear sites. I want to ask you, was this a necessary show of strength or the spark that you think could ignite a wider war? And I want you to kind of give your reaction to how things unfolded. And Peter, we'll start with you.
Well, I think things unfolded as well as the United States could have reasonably hoped. President Trump told Iran that they had 60 days to return to the negotiating table. They didn't return to the negotiating table. All throughout the Israeli strikes, President Trump had asked the Iranians to return to the negotiating table as late as Saturday, June 22nd. The Iranians refused to return to the negotiating table. And so the United States made good on what Donald Trump has been promising since before he was elected president the second time, that Iran could not obtain a nuclear weapon. All the intelligence is not yet in, but the initial reports are that the United States inflicted severe damage on the nuclear installations at Fordo, at Isfahan, and Natanz, where in mountain fortresses, the Iranians have thousands of centrifuges producing highly enriched uranium that has no use for civilian purposes, that has whose only use is for military purposes. So the military objective was achieved. It was achieved, it seems, cleanly. It seems that all of our soldiers, our airmen and our air women, our sailors have returned safely.
And I want to just ask you a quick follow-up there, Peter, because originally the president had said, look, we're going to give them 2 weeks. The 2 weeks had not yet expired. Do you have any issues or reaction to the sort of mixed messaging that occurred there?
Yes, I actually don't think it was a mixed messaging. What he said was, I will make my decision within 2 weeks. But the deadline had already lapsed. The Iranians had more time. They knew that B-2 stealth bombers were flying from westward from Missouri. That flight took a day and a half, even though those were not the stealth bombers that were used. The Iranians had plenty of time. And remember as well, negotiations with Iran have been underway since the 2013, when the Obama administration first reached an agreement with Iran that there should be negotiations. So we're not talking about a few weeks or a few months. We're talking about 12 years.
And Sean, I want to get your reaction to the way things went down over the weekend, your thoughts.
Absolutely. Well, first, let me just say I really enjoyed your description of Professor Welbeck's upcoming Kendrick Lamar class at my university. The Department of Africana and Africology Studies is actually four floors above me in the same building at Temple. So I'll be sure to check that out, actually, once the academic semester starts. I think you have laid out what happened over the last 72 hours quite accurately. I mean, my fear now is that the U.S. strikes against those three nuclear facilities in Iran will not be one-off strikes, but they will be the entree to another endless, and I think ultimately destructive and needless war in the Middle East that will herald a new era of instability and chaos for the region, which will not be good, obviously, for the Iranian people. It won't be good for Israel, and it certainly will not be good for the United States or our Arab allies. I think it's important to note that while policymakers in our country have framed the attacks as a precision strike, and by all, you know, but from what we've gotten in the public sphere, it seems to be just that. It was not a small strike. This was the largest stealth bomber mission ever undertaken. It used nearly half of our country's entire B-2 stealth bomber fleet. It involved a nuclear submarine in the Gulf, likely the USS Georgia, firing cruise missiles at Iranian targets simultaneously. And in addition, what we've seen over the last 48 hours with the latest tit-for-tat strikes between Israel and Iran, and our president's tweet within the last 24 hours is that regime change is now on the table, right? The attacks that the Israeli military, and to be fair, the Iranian military in which they're training now, are not against purely military targets. In the last 24 hours, for instance, Israeli missiles and jets have hit the headquarters of the Basij, which is the state-run paramilitary wing. It's hit a political prison. It's hit other government installations. And this is all fine and well if the war were indeed a war for regime change. And yet we're told at times, we've been told incessantly by our policymakers, particularly I'm thinking of Vice President J.D. Vance yesterday, Sunday, that this is not a war against Iran.
Yeah.
This is a war against Iranian nuclear facilities, which to me is a very peculiar way in my field of political science of framing this. Like, that's like saying we can take out Russian or North Korean nuclear sites and those sites alone. But that doesn't mean we're at war with Russia or North Korea.
And
it means we're at war.
Yeah, and I want our audience to hear with what Vice President J.D. Vance had to say. We're going to play that clip so that they were on the same page. Go ahead.
So we're not at war with Iran. We're at war with Iran's nuclear program. And the Iranians have a choice. They can go down the path of peace, or they can go down the path of this ridiculous brinksmanship, of funding terrorism, of trying to build a nuclear weapon. And that's just not something the United States can accept.
And so you argue, Sean, that we are now at war because of the scope of the strike over the weekend. Is that your argument, Sean?
Yes, it's not only my argument. I think it is the de facto reality. And I think the tragedy in my mind, coming from the perspective of a Middle East scholar, is that the real solution to nuclear nonproliferation for Iran was always, and it always had to be diplomacy. Yeah. This was why former President Obama signed the JCPOA, right, nearly a decade ago. It was why many diplomats and researchers and specialists and scholars of regional affairs scratched their heads when President Trump in his first term tore up that agreement in 2018. And what the latest strikes, I think, do, whether or not they lead to a long-term war for regime change, is give the Iranian government even less incentive to disarm itself and to accept the basic norm of nuclear nonproliferation. And this is coming from the perspective, finally, and I'll end here, of a scholar that has no sympathy for the Iranian regime, right? Because I don't think any responsible scholar can. This is an illiberal autocracy. It is part of a very small number of dictatorships in the world that has engaged in, say, transnational repression, that has coerced much of its own society, and whose legitimacy is increasingly tenuous. That all said, the operational question I think we need to ask, I think as citizens now in the United States, is, are we willing to accept a situation that was begun 2 weeks ago, not by the United States, but by the government of Israel, that could end in a long-term war for regime change, echoing our disaster in Iraq, that can only result in needless American casualties and, I think, another calamity for the regional affairs?
Yeah,
and I don't think the answer is yes.
And I'm going to bring Peter back into the conversation, but first I'm going to bring in a caller. We have Bryce from West Philadelphia on the line. Bryce, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
We're good. What's your question or comment, Bryce?
So my comment is actually about the reality of U.S. imperialism and the threat that the United States is building for itself long term. Because essentially what the United States is doing right now is, via its airstrikes, right, which came as not even a true unilateral decision, but a decision that kind of like is not a true declaration of war, is they've declared that they and only their allies can determine what is allowable for other countries. For example, the nuclear program of Iran is being described as if it is primarily a weapons program, although over several decades, over my entire lifetime, most of the international reviews of the nuclear program has shown that Iran is using this primarily for energy. Mm-hmm. And this attack, right, will only push countries in the global south that believe that the United States or places like Israel are a threat to seek more lethal and dangerous weapons as a method of protecting themselves. So really, like, people should not cheer this on. People should not be like, oh, Iran is an adversarial country, they're a threat. People should consider the true human cost, which is going to be the lives of the most vulnerable and most oppressed in the region, which are going to be working class people, families, poor folk, and soldiers that come from poor areas like where I come from, that are probably going to get like bombarded with bombs because of a decision by the people in the ruling strata society.
All right. Thank you so much, Bryce, from West Philadelphia, for your comment. And Peter, I want to give you a chance to respond. I saw a little bit of reaction there. And also, I mean, this begs the wider question. And you mentioned that this has been going on. These negotiations have been going on for many years. But multiple presidents have been, including President Donald Trump during his first term, has been very reluctant to take this type of military action against Iran. I want you to kind of talk about why and what made the moment now different.
Yes, thank you. In the process, I hope I can address a few, a few misconceptions. First, I don't agree that that America's strike has somehow introduced a new era of instability and chaos into the Middle East. We're living in the midst of an era of instability and chaos, one round of which was initiated by Iran-backed Hamas on October 7, 2023, when the jihadists invaded Israel, slaughtered 1,200, mostly civilians, took 250 hostages. The next day, Iran-backed Hezbollah began a year-long campaign of aerial assaults from southern Lebanon on northern Israel. Iran-backed Houthis joined in. Also part of the Ring of Fire was Syria. Iran's Ring of Fire was Syria and Iraq. So this is just one recent round in a campaign against Israel, against the United States, and really against the West that the Islamic Republic of Iran launched from the moment of the Iranian that it achieved power through the Iranian Revolution in 1979. So we're in an ongoing period of instability and chaos. Jerry, you ask, why now?
Why now?
Why now? Fair enough. First of all, the reports of the International Atomic Energy Association, they reported that this year, one, that they believe that that Iran had developed three covert enrichment facilities. This is IAEA information. They reported that in the facilities that they're monitoring, Iran had stepped up enrichment to levels way beyond what's required for civilian energy. By the way, to quickly address a point made by the caller,
Bryce,
Iran does not rely on nuclear energy for its electricity or energy. Iran is a nuclear-rich country. Its facility at Bashir produces something like 3% of the nation's electricity. No country in the world that relies on nuclear power for civil energy has thousands of centrifuges buried hundreds of feet under mountains. Moreover, the Israelis reported, and they delivered the intelligence to the United States, that Iran had actually stepped up enrichment and stepped up weaponization. And you have to remember, this is in the midst of a cycle of Iranian missile attacks on Israel, around 300 in April 2024 and around another 300 in October 2024. We are in the midst of a seven-front Iran war against Israel.
Yeah, and I see you moving around, Sean. Did you want to respond to this? Because I do push this question of why now? What made, I don't understand the rationale for why this moment was the moment that the U.S. needed to make this strike and get involved in this.
Well, I would just say, you know, the following in respect to what Peter, you know, graciously mentioned in terms of the wars that Israel has been fighting previously, prior to the current war against Iran, in terms of Hamas's attack, terrorist attacks in October 2023, the war against Hezbollah that followed quickly after, the strikes against the Iran-backed Houthi movement, all those things are true insofar that, and I can speak just for myself, and I think many other regional experts who've studied the Middle East for a living, the Islamic Republic of Iran, right, is a cancer upon the region. There's no doubt about that. There is its so-called axis of resistance, which also includes, by the way, Shia militias in Iraq, which have attacked U.S. forces in Jordan and Iraq. The actions that the Iranian regime, and a non-democratic, illiberal one at that, have undertaken in the region are chaotic. They've harmed people. And as Peter has importantly mentioned, they have, you know, they've threatened, they've resulted not just in the needless deaths of many Israelis, but they've resulted, I think, as well downstream in the Gaza conflict today, which has also killed over 56,000 Palestinians. But the important thing to note, and I think this is my decisive point, is that this is orthogonal to the issue of whether or not the U.S. should involve itself in a war to destroy nuclear facilities in a country where the justification for going to war was this is a rogue regime that is about to acquire nuclear weapons, right? That's the key issue here. It's not that the Iranian regime is a cancer upon the Middle East, because it's been this way for decades. And yet the U.S. has not unilaterally launched a barrage of attacks against this Iranian regime. Right? It's relied upon diplomacy and other forms of coercion to contain Iran. The question to my mind is why, you know, as you've noted, why now? And, you know, what will be the ultimate consequences of this? My fear is that, and again, I just want to go back to the point I raised earlier. In my view, the diplomatic solution was always the right one. This was the goal behind the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Peace Agreement for Nuclear Nonproliferation that Iran signed onto, and which was ended by President Trump in his first term in 2018. If we agree, like if we believe that diplomacy was no longer an option, then I believe that we have to credibly accede to the following, that given that diplomacy was no longer on the table, that had Iran been allowed to continue developing its nuclear weapons, then Iran would have credibly and unilaterally launched nuclear weapons in a manner against Israel or other or Arab allies of the United States.
Yeah.
In a way that would have certainly have brought about the end to its own existence, given the not just the global condemnation that would have wrought, but the sheer might of American-led and a retaliation that would have annihilated the regime, since it would have been the first use of nuclear weapons since World War II. Now, if we believe the answer to that is yes, that Iran was an imminent existential threat to either Israel or Western civilization, then the only solution to this kind of cancer is regime change.
Yeah.
Right? Because we fought a world war against fascism. We went into places like Korea and Vietnam to defeat communism. We do not simply contain existential imminent threats to Western civilization. We destroy them. But yet, that's clearly not on the table, at least so far, for our government.
And
right?
If
the answer is, yeah, I'm sorry?
And the government, I mean, the Trump administration officials have said that regime change was not an option or was not the goal. But we've seen the president hint in a post on Truth Social just yesterday that regime change could be possible. He says, make Iran great again, MEGA, on his site. So is that shift? And when you talk about regime change, how does that shift our view and our tactic in Iran? And I'm asking you, Peter, to jump in the conversation.
Yes. So today, the Trump administration made clear that regime change is not the goal. But I don't agree that if the United States was convinced that Iran was had now put itself only steps away, a few weeks away from producing a nuclear weapon, that the only serious viable response was regime change, as if the war against Iran really is similar to the war against fascism or the Cold War. Iran does not have a serious army, especially now after Israel's attacks. It is possible with the technology we have to severely grade, if not totally destroy, its Iran's nuclear facilities, as we've witnessed. Moreover, it has always been the aim of the Trump administration to proceed through diplomacy. I should mention here that I served for 2 years as the head of the policy planning staff in the first Trump administration. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, after we withdrew from the JCPOA, imposed what he called the maximum pressure campaign. This was a campaign of sanctions whose purpose was to bring Iran back to the negotiating table, but on terms favorable to the United States. That maximum pressure campaign was working quite successfully when the Biden administration reversed it. Iran has been proceeding much more quickly. Everybody asks, and reasonably, by the way, why now? Again, I repeat, because Iran has been progressing steadily toward a nuclear weapon since the late 1990s. We've known that it's been close for many years.
And we
new intelligence suggested that Iranians were just on the verge. And
and we have to take a break. We'll leave it right there, and we'll pick up on the other side. What's your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities? You can call us 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We're going to talk about the political fallout and other things on the other side of this break. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg, and we are continuing our discussion about the U.S. airstrikes on Iran over the weekend, as well as our involvement in the war in the Middle East. With us are Sean Yam, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, and Peter Berkowitz, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And you, our listeners, you can join our conversation. The question to you today is this: what's your reaction to President Trump's decision to attack Iranian nuclear facilities? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comments in the chat. I'm going to read a couple comments. We have Jeff. We have Henry from Middletown, Delaware, who says he clearly committed another unconstitutional act by ignoring Congress's authority in such matters. We have Matt from Norristown, Pennsylvania, who reacts that he's furious but not surprised. Look for such distractions whenever his poll numbers drop. And Elizabeth alleges that the attack was, quote, previously planned. People having very strong reactions to the U.S. strike over the weekend. And so I want to move our conversation forward a little bit because Iran has threatened retaliation, both by military and through proxy actors. And so, Sean, what do you think would be the most likely response to these strikes that took place over the weekend?
Well, I think from the Iranian perspective, there's not much they can do. And this actually reflects upon a point that Peter made that I want to engage as well. The aperture for an effective military response is quite limited. There has been talk, for instance, of the Iranian military attempting to close the Straits of Hormuz, which would choke off maritime oil tanker traffic through the Persian or Arabian Gulf. There is talk of the Houthi movement of Yemen, one of its axis of resistance proxy actors, waging aerial assaults against Israel and causing chaos elsewhere in Yemen or otherwise. There is talk of elements of Hezbollah reconstituting themselves in Lebanon, where they no longer play a part really in mainstream Lebanese politics, and of waging or relitigating their unsuccessful war against Israel. I think that thus far, the reason why we have not seen the kind of fiery response that was promised by the Iranian leadership is because they do not have the leverage or the means to respond credibly and effectively against not just the Israeli military, but now the combined might of U.S. military forces in the Persian or the Arabian Gulf. It cannot be understated how much firepower agglomerates in that waterway on account of our military apparatus. We operate an enormous army infantry base in Kuwait, Camp Arifshan, Central Command's Air Command, basically a giant air force, is located at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. The Fifth Fleet of the United States Navy is headquartered in Bahrain. So there is a sufficient amount of firepower in the Gulf to deter, I think, any irrational Iranian response. But this is where I want to briefly engage, Peter's point as well. Peter, one of the things you mentioned, and obviously quite intelligently, because I know of your service, to the country and your work in policy planning in the State Department, is that the fear is that not only would Iran obtain nuclear weapons, but that it could credibly use them in a way that could obviously threaten either in the United States, Israel, or their shared Arab allies. But yet, one of the things you also mentioned is that Iran also is not at the same level of a threat as, say, fascism or communism. I think this is an important distinction to make, because if you recall, some of the rhetoric, right, arguably some of it coming from Israeli leaders, but some of it repeated, right, as you know, by American policymakers, is that the Islamic Republic of Iran, in addition to being an illiberal autocracy and an outright dictatorship, like many other countries are, is an existential threat to the West, right? Which justifies the military strikes against Iran. And yet, at the same time, one of the things that I think we can concede is that Iran is not at the level of these kind of existential imminent threats, and that its own military apparatus, even before the current war with Israel began, nearly 2 weeks ago, was in not anywhere close to the same level, that nowhere close to credibly threatening, say, the U.S. military
But Sean,
or even Israel.
could there be
Yeah.
other types of threats? Because the there's been a lot of talk about sleeper cells, bringing some type of threat to the American soil. What other types of response could Iran have to these strikes? And Peter, you
Well,
can
I,
weigh in.
you know, that, I'm sorry, no, go, would you
Go
like me
ahead.
to go or?
You want to finish your thought, Sean?
I can finish here. I make these conceptual distinctions and taking these, I think, ephemeral threats into account to make, my final point, that we can't have it both ways. We cannot say Iran is a paper tiger and therefore doesn't threaten the United States or the West, but then also say Iran is a tiger and will threaten the West, and this is why the military strikes were warranted. I think we need a principled response and an understanding of what Iran is. Iran, as I've stated before, is an illiberal regime. It is not a democracy. It has indeed sowed chaos and instability across the region, but in a way that does not make it distinctive across a broad expanse of Middle East or other regional histories when we're dealing with rogue regimes. We find them in every other region. So the critical question I think that we have to wrestle with, even if it's befuddling to us now, is, are we comfortable with the level of military response to Iran that could potentially result in a long-term conflict between Iran and either the United States or increasingly likely Israel, which by all accounts, I think we have to concede is prepared to wage a long-term war against this country. And I just don't think that future is one that will bring stability to the region.
Yeah, and Peter, did you want to weigh in here? I mean,
I did.
yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm grateful to Sean for laying out what he thinks to be a contradiction, but I think it turns out not to be a contradiction at all. Iran is not Nazi Germany. It's not the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, it does present an existential threat to Israel and tremendous danger to the United States, especially if it acquires a nuclear weapon. Look, for decades, Iran has been building what they call a ring of fire around Israel. Iranian proxies in the Gaza Strip, Hamas, in the West Bank, also Hamas. Hezbollah is an Iranian proxy. The Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, thankfully, he's been ousted. The Houthis in Yemen. The purpose of this ring of fire was to crush and destroy Israel. And but for the resilience and heroism of the Israeli army following the October 7th attacks, further massacres might have happened. God knows what would have happened if Hezbollah had joined in immediately. But second, as President Rafsanjani, former president of Iran, had once said, or prime minister, I'm not sure, had said, but has been repeated, Israel is a one-bomb country. Israel's a tiny country, the size of New Jersey. Half of its population lives in the greater Tel Aviv area. It is run not by materialists and secularists like those who ran the Soviet Union, but by Islamic extremists who think there's a reward for them laid up in heaven in martyrdom. The Israelis have concluded reasonably that even one nuclear weapon in Iran's hands is an existential threat, and therefore it seems justified. Moreover, we know from Saudi Arabia, we know from an interview that MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, gave 60 Minutes several years ago, that one, Saudi Arabia does not want nuclear weapons, but two, if Iran acquires a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia will acquire a nuclear weapon. Now, if Saudi Arabia acquires a nuclear weapon, nuclear weapons, is there any reason to believe that other Gulf monarchies, Turkey, won't acquire nuclear weapons? Then, surrounding the Persian Gulf, through which 20% of the world's oil flows, we will have a nuclear weapon tinderbox. And I assure you, people say, well, that you're making it just about oil. If the price of oil skyrockets, because of the tremendous instability in the Gulf, the first people to be injured will be poor people around the world
yeah.
as their heating oil and their air conditioning prices skyrocket.
And I want to bring in a couple callers. We have Catherine from Allentown on the line. Catherine, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yes, I've been listening with dismay to these two scholars talking about this situation because historically they have not mentioned the history, our history in foreign policy in Iran, that we supported the Shah of Iran, a terrible despot and torturer for decades and decades, and we also helped overthrow previously, before the Shah, Mossadegh, who was a democratic elected person. So we have a history in this area of Iran. And my question is, didn't these historians hear the story on BBC this morning that said that the fissile material that supposedly was bombed out of existence by President Trump was actually transported away before the bombs fell? So Iran perhaps does not have a destroyed ability to create nuclear weapons. And I just want to say I'm sickened by our foreign policy. I was in my teens during Vietnam, and then there's so many other. If the area of the Middle East, we have no business being there. We're always involved with dictators and despots. Our military budget is approaching $1 trillion,
yeah.
and people in Pennsylvania, our representative, just voted to cut Medicaid. So I'm not interested in a long discussion about, you know, who's a paper tiger and who isn't. If you don't have an historical perspective of our horrible foreign policy, then to me it's worthless. We need diplomacy. That's what we need. And
yeah.
our president doesn't seem to understand the definition of the word.
Thank you very much. That's Catherine from Allentown. I also want to bring in Steve from Newtown, who's on the phone. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I had 30 years in the military. I'm an Afghanistan veteran. I there's no problem with not wanting a rogue state or a terrorist state to have a nuclear weapon. But the hypocrisy of this, Iran did not invade an ally of ours and kill tens and thousands of that ally. They're called Ukrainians, and Russia did. And being able to have all this muscle power and all this show against Iran is just misguided and hypocritical, because the same could be shown to Russia, to Putin, and say this is the price of not getting out or suing for peace or giving up the land. This is just, I agree with the previous caller in the one sense, it's a rogue president that just does whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Russia is the existential threat, and it threatens NATO, and it threatens the free world. We got to get our priorities straight.
Yeah, thank you. That's Steve from Newtown. And we only have about 3.5 minutes left in this conversation, but I really want to talk about the political fallout. I mean, you know, most Americans have strongly agreed that Iran has been a threat, but at the same time, they are against the U.S. involving itself militarily in the Middle East on this. They've wanted diplomacy. We've heard that from both of our callers. What is the next step that you see? A lot of people have said that President Trump may have overstepped his executive authority here and that he should have involved Congress. What is the next step that you see? And if you could be brief so we could try to, we only have a couple minutes left. And Sean, I want to bring you back in. And then Peter, of course, I would like to hear your thoughts. The next steps. Should Congress get involved in this? Because many think we could end up in a war.
I would like to think that Congress would become involved in this, partly because I think this was an executive overreach on part of President Trump. And I think it's part of a broader, unfortunate episode of Democratic backsliding we're suffering from in our Democratic Republic. I also just want to say in endings or my thoughts here that as we think about the next steps, which hopefully will indeed be diplomacy, a return to the bargaining table, a de-escalation of conflict, a persuasion of both Israel and the Islamic Republic to stop lobbing missiles and drones against one another, is that we remember that diplomacy was always supposed to be the way out of this mess. This was the whole purpose of the JCPOA. This was the reason why we set deadline after deadline of diplomatic negotiations
yeah.
before, and we only care about those deadlines now. 12 days ago, a 2-week deadline to Russia, to President
yeah.
Putin expired.
Mm-hmm.
right, for ending the Ukrainian conflict, there were no consequences.
And
it's
I got to.
important, I think, for listeners to know that breaking a diplomatic deadline doesn't mean that diplomacy is dead. We have to return to the negotiating table to save lives and to save the region.
And Peter, I got to give you last 45 seconds here. Go right ahead.
You got it. We did give diplomacy a chance. We've been negotiating for 12 years with Iran. They've continued to proceed toward producing a nuclear weapon. The strike was constitutional. President Trump was authorized under the AUMF from September 11, 2001. And because the Iran-backed Houthis have been attacking American shipping, the United States was entitled to respond in Iran. As far as bringing Congress in, yes, at this stage, we should be bringing Congress in. And finally, the situation in Iraq is in Ukraine is quite different. We've given tens of billions of dollars of support to the Ukrainians. We haven't neglected them.
Yeah. Thank you very much to both of you for your time today. We have Sean Yom, who is an associate professor of political science at Temple University. Also, Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of our callers. We got a lot of comments in that we didn't get a chance to get to today. But this is going to be an ongoing conversation, I'm sure. So thank you to our producers. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for being here and joining us today.